Good afternoon, everybody. The committee will come to order. We have this year, or this session, a very fast-paced and exciting agenda. So that is on the good side. I suppose on the negative side, we have a very fast-paced and exciting agenda. So I hope that all of you have come back to St. Paul with the idea of putting in some long hours and working pretty hard together. And Representative Mack, it's good to see you. I haven't seen you for a while. Hope things are going well.
They are. Good to see you, too.
Good. So what we're doing today, members, a lot of the bills that we are looking at today are bills that have come back to us for various reasons. And the first one that we're going to take up is Representative Schomacher's bill, Senate File 894, which was on the House floor and never got heard. And so the procedure is that it comes back to us just to be sent back to the floor, and hopefully this time to get taken care of. So at this time, Representative Schomacher moves that Senate File 894 be re-referred to the General Register. And welcome to the committee, Representative Schomacher. Welcome back. And would you like to say anything about this?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a little refresher on what this is. It's a rate utilization guide change. The MDS at the federal level had made some changes to the way that nursing home patients were residents were admitted. And we had implemented the rate utilization guide 4 into statute for tax for federal conformity a few years ago, and this bill basically gets rid of rate utilization guide 3 that is no longer used, and so it's really just cleaning that up.
Great, thank you, Representative Schomacher. Sounds kind of unsession to me. Yeah.
If you will, Madam Chair.
Yes. Any questions for members, or if anybody's awake or around the table after that explanation? I know this isn't the most exciting. And Representative Schomacher, we really appreciate that you take these issues on and that you dig into them and understand them fully, because I know that not every member is able to do that. So any questions? All right, seeing none, Representative Schomacher renews his motion that Senate File 894 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right, the motion prevails, and off it goes to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Schomacher.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda is House File 1348, Representative Abler. And again, members, this is a bill that we heard during the interim. We gave it an informational hearing. And just to be clear, Representative Abler does have an amendment, which we will take up and discuss in the normal way. And then it is the chair's intention to take a vote on this, to pass it along to the Finance Committee, where it will be considered with other sort of like issues. So that's what we're doing here today. Representative Abler, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know there's a small amount of controversy about the bill, but it's attempting to solve a problem. And I appreciate members working with me along the way to accomplish a good thing. And so with that, I'll move House File 1348 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Human Services Finance.
Okay, so Representative Abler moves that House File 1348 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Is there any...
I have an amendment too, Madam.
Yes,
Chair.
Why don't you move your amendment?
Anyway, so we had a discussion during the off-season about spend downs and the fact that if you're $1 over the limit, you have to actually spend down to 75%. And the ironic thing is that the $250 or whatever that amounts to is in the fee-for-service world is absorbed by the people bringing the bill forward. So they actually may be disinclined to even serve the individual who has a spend down. That's the whole purpose of the main bill. And it was a consensus, I think, of the members that it was really silly to have a $1 penalty costing somebody $250. And so I know that may cost some money, but in just keeping with that discussion, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, if I could, Madam Chair, and then I'll explain it.
Okay. Representative Abler moves the A1 amendment that is in your packets. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment?
Well, let me explain it, Madam Chair.
Please.
And so this gets rid of the penalty, pretty much. And so it would restore the level to 100%. And so there you wouldn't have to you have to spend down to the 100%, not the 75%, and so some spend downs are much higher than that. But this takes away the silly penalty. Right now, that's only true of people with disabilities, not true of people who are just low income or otherwise. And actually, the people who are low income actually get the privilege of having 133 or 138% as their number. And so at least this gets rid of the penalty. So because you had one more dollar, you don't come to harm. So that's the point of the amendment. And I'm not sure what it's going to cost. I couldn't get an answer out of the health plans, the prepaid health plans, PMAP ones. Don't have this problem because somehow they deal with it internally, but I don't know how they deal with it internally. And I have it's my view that perhaps nobody pays for this, and so it's a penalty that only causes harm to people. And so I think in terms of an unsessioned idea, Madam Chair, this is an idea that should be definitely unned into oblivion. So that's the amendment, and I'll take all comers on the way to work on this as it works its way through the finance process, Madam Chair.
Okay. Questions for members? Okay, seeing none. So Representative Abler has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The amendment is adopted. So, okay. So any further discussion on the bill as amended? Members, the intention is to send this to finance where it can be considered with the, there's a Loeffler bill that kind of deals with similar topic.
Right.
And, you know, I would not presume anything about what Representative Huntley will do with it when it gets there, but I don't know what kind of money he's going to have to spend or how he's going to have to prioritize it, Representative Huntley.
Well, I, Madam Chair and Representative Abel, I certainly support the concept. And I think it's foolish that one group has to spend down to 75% and another group has to spend down to 100%. Who knows what my target's going to be. And everything's going to have to fit within that target, whatever the spending is. But I certainly support the idea of this bill.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative.
And Madam Chair, just to that.
Representative Abler.
You know, one of the privileges of being in the minority is you can propose all kinds of good ideas and ask the majority to pay for it. So... So I urge you guys to consider this very worthy idea. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Abler. Sometimes we call that you're spending the money. You just don't raise the money. Right?
So, thank you, Madam Chair. We'll get there while we're ahead, I think. So.
All right. So Representative Abler then renews his motion that House File 1348 be re-referred as amended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Off it goes. Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Fritz, House File 2023. Welcome back. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to be here.
So Representative Fritz is going to move that House File 2023 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance as well. And Representative Fritz, you have an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do.
And which one is that, Representative Fritz?
I think there are two.
The A1.
Okay, I see a DE in here also. Is that somebody else's? She should move it. Okay, Representative Fritz, you should move the DE3, I'm told. Okay. So Representative Fritz moves the DE3 amendment. And Representative Fritz, do you want to tell us or have somebody come up and tell us what the DE3 is doing?
I would like, if one of the folks would like to come, I can begin. We did have a good hearing on this a week ago. I think that for most of the committee, they would remember that. Yes, I'll have Dr. them come up with their explanation. But actually, if you read through the amendment, it pretty much talks about changing. In my nursing career, it was always a private duty nurse that was taking care of people in their homes. And so we've made some changes in the language there to call it home care nursing. And then I think there's another amendment too. That am I correct that the nurse from the scope of nursing, which just cleaned that up a little bit because we wanted to keep it all consistent with the scope of nursing practice. But let's talk about this amendment first, and I'll hand it over
right.
to these
Representative
folks.
Fritz, I'm not familiar with the amendment, so I don't okay. know what they're doing, and I'm hoping that your folks are going to explain.
Yeah,
so.
And we will.
Okay,
thank you.
Please
go ahead.
Welcome.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. I'm Lisa Flynn from Hiawatha Home Care and a member of PHCC. And first of all, eliminating the private duty nursing was part of the original, and that's because all insurance companies call that an exclusion, and that by CMS's definition is private duty is non-physician directed care. Some of our amendments in here are to more define the fact that we are doing skilled nursing interventions that are based on the recipient's needs, and then we made sure that they said that it's that home care nursing must be performed by a registered nurse or licensed practical nurse within their scope of practice as defined by the Nurse Practice Act, which is important so people don't think that they're doing things they shouldn't be doing. And then we're also trying to define what complex compared to regular home care nursing services, what they include. And we took some information out of other statutes for the regular nursing, saying that the recipient requires more individual continuous care than you can do during a skilled nursing visit. And it's out of the scope of services from a person, PCA or home health aid, that they can provide. So we're trying to clearly define verbiage that has not been redefined in many years to show what we're doing and how important the care is that we're providing.
Okay, Dr. thank Maynard. You. Mm-hmm. And so we're just, that's just on the DE3 amendment?
Correct.
And maybe Mr. Chun, I don't know if you drafted that. Maybe you could also comment, if you would, on and just sort of tell us what the differences are between the original bill and the DE.
Madam Chair and members, I think some of the differences is that there's been a lot of work in sort of rewriting the current definitions of private duty or what was called private duty nursing. For example, the definition of there's also some changes in terminology. The private duty nursing was initially called or renamed in-home nursing, and then it's now named in this amendment home care nursing. There's also some differences if you look in paragraph D in the definition of regular home care nursing, where the clauses 1 and 2 at the bottom of the DE3 amendment pick up some of the language in current law that defines the need for private duty nursing. And then I believe there'll be another amendment that will be offered. This would be the A1 amendment that will change some of the payment rate increase language in Section 2, and also will be removing in paragraph F on the top of page 2 of the DE3 amendment, there was a third tier of nursing services called technology-dependent home care nursing. And I believe one of the amendments that will be offered will remove that.
Okay. Okay, does that sound, Representative
yes.
Fritz? Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, that
okay.
pretty well describes all
right.
three amendments. So.
Okay, well, let's just take them one at a time. Okay. So, members, are there any questions on the DE3? Okay, so all in favor of the DE3, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, motion prevails. So the DE3 is now before us. And then do you want to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair,
Fritz?
If I could, please.
So Representative Fritz moves the A1 amendment. And do you want to just, I think Mr. Chun just kind of explained that changes some of the rates. Maybe does anybody want to comment on that one further? Or now that we're looking at this one, Mr. Chun, maybe you would want to just sort of tell us again exactly what this one is doing.
Okay. That's good. Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment, it further, I guess, modifies a little bit of the definitions of the different nursing categories. Mm-hmm. Then it modifies the rate increase that's being requested. It would be asking for a 19% increase in the cases of both of the categories affected. And then, as mentioned, it does get rid of the third higher tier category, the technology-dependent nursing category.
Okay, any questions on that, members, or comments? Okay, so on the A1 amendment, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, no. Okay, motion prevails. And in your packets, we have one more amendment. Is that also
Madam
yours?
Chair. Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Yeah, that's mine.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I could, I'll move the A2 amendment.
Okay, Representative Abler moves the A2, so please go
and ahead. I'll explain it. And I'll Mr. Chun, it's kind of technical, but having done a lot of licensing work with the nurses, et cetera, there's words do matter, and technical words, even though they seem arcane, really make a big difference. And so this, we'll just conform it to the Nurse Practice Act to make sure it doesn't change anything unnecessarily. Maybe Mr. Chun could say that's all it does, but I'm sure he wrote it, so he could tell you specifically what it does, so members are informed.
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair and members, the DE3 amendment lists certain, I guess, activities or services that are within the scope of the definition of home care nursing. And as Representative Abler states, this amendment, his A2 amendment, sort of gets rid of those the mentioning of specific services. And I guess you could say it's a broader definition that talks about the services that are performed under the scope of practice, under the Nurse Practice Act.
Okay, questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps Mr. Chun can clarify. I'm just trying to understand when it broadens the scope, is that a fiscal issue as well, or is it just providing some more flexibility? I'm just not quite sure the impact of that.
Madam Chair and Mr. Loeffler, if you notice in the DE3 amendment on lines, I guess page 1, lines 13 through 15, they mentioned things like skilled nursing interventions, based on the recipient's assessed needs and so on. What the Abler amendment does is to remove those specific references. So it talks about, sort of piggybacks on the current language about being performed within the scope of practice as defined under the Nurse Practice Act. And then adds a final clause that this is being done in order to maintain or restore a person's optimal health. I guess I don't know, enough about nursing practice to know whether or not, this change will lead to an additional cost or savings.
Madam Chair, and to that point, it doesn't broaden the scope. It actually identifies the scope. And we did some work on that last year. We've talked about that in this committee before. So, no, it does not broaden the scope. But it actually identifies the work, and the procedures, and the technology, and the RN and the LPN, the position, mm-hmm. and the work that is necessary, and the technology. So I think it defines more than anything.
Ms. Flynn.
Madam Chair and members, in order to maintain or restore a person's optimal health actually will be to the benefit of, fiscally, because it's cohesive with what CMS now is doing, the chronic care, and they can't deny people because they are not getting better or restorative. And also with the look at private insurance, they like to see people turn custodial, per se, when they're not constantly going in the hospital. And no, it's because we're maintaining them, mm-hmm. and optimizing everything that can be done for them in the home to stay home, and therefore it'll help prevent some denials at the private insurance level also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess, Mr. Chun, could you, this is all modifying this section B, mm-hmm. or sub B in the on the DE, and I wonder if you could just maybe read us what the language says with the amendment on it. Maybe that would be helpful.
Okay, sure. Madam Chair, members, paragraph B as amended would read, home care nursing means ongoing physician-ordered hourly nursing services performed by a registered nurse or a licensed practical nurse within the scope of practice as defined by Minnesota Nurse Practice Act under sections 148.171 to 148.285 in order to maintain or restore a person's optimal health.
Madam Chair?
Okay, thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And what I'm thinking about is many of the people who receive this type of nursing are really on, let's just say, the down escalator because of the the expected prognosis of their disease, I'm thinking. And so if we say in order to maintain or restore a person's optimum health, does that in any way cut out people for whom the benefit might be to slow the loss of optimum functioning? Or, you know, dealing with that situation in which, you know, unfortunately, people find themselves in where we know because of the progression of their diagnosis that their abilities will deteriorate. And I don't want this language to be used by an insurer or anyone else to deny that kind of care to someone for whom the care really can't be expected to even maintain their current abilities. And so I'm just trying to interpret how this might be used by various parties in that healthcare interaction. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a little worried about not addressing that situation by this wording. And I don't think that was Representative Abler's intent at all. But we do find situations in which, you know, even being able to maintain is a losing battle. But that doesn't mean that good care can't slow the progression of deterioration. And maybe we could hear from our witness or others who actually know more than I do about nursing care and all the diagnoses that this might apply to. But
well, I have a doctor here that can answer that.
Okay, Representative Fritz, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, Dr. Roy Maynard, I am a practicing pediatric subspecialist in Minnesota, and I have been intimately involved in the care of medically complex children for over two decades. I'm also a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Executive Committee on Home Care. I can assure you that in the pediatric world, where I have my experience, that we have many children we provide care for who live at home, who are nurtured at home, who are cognitively intact, but who have disabilities that preclude them from enjoying the things that those of us can enjoy walking around here. These kids go to school, they study, they learn. Some of them will not be able to hold jobs in the future, but some of them will. They're dependent upon their underlying diagnosis. They may not have a limited lifespan in the sense that you think of for elderly patients who are disabled and in a home care situation. The problem that I have seen over the past decade in Minnesota, and this is across the nation as well, is that the population of medically complex children has doubled in the past 10 years, and it will continue to grow. As a consequence, to maintain the cost of providing for these children who do have a reasonable quality of life in the home, you have to provide nursing care to help the parents, to prevent burnout, to prevent costly hospital readmissions, and to help prevent illnesses and sicknesses in the home. Kids who are taken care of by skilled nursing, very difficult to prove, but I can tell you that myself and my colleagues would probably tell you, cost the system less money if we can provide good quality of care for them in the home and keep them at home, allow them to go to school and live with their families where they're loved and nurtured.
Right. And Dr. Maynard, sorry to interrupt, but we did have a full hearing on this, and I don't think we're really debating these points, but really the question that's really before us is on this A2 amendment and whether these changes to the language you know, do you want, can you comment specifically on that? I don't know if you were tracking the changes. It's basically a change to the definition of home care nursing that was in the amendment that Representative Fritz moved forward here, and kind of the point that Representative Loeffler was concerned about was that last phrase, in order to maintain or restore a person's optimal health. So, in other words, if this was to pass with the amendment as stated, and somebody was to need care that wasn't going to maintain or restore their optimal health, that would not be part of it. They wouldn't be able to have the home care nursing, because that wouldn't be, it would define them out of that bucket. So that's kind of the question before us. Ms. Flynn, did you want to, was that, did I get your
yes,
name?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yeah. Yes, it is, and members. We do take care of the chronic, the ones that do regress instead of progress, and that is a maintaining. Even though they're declining in their health status, you're still maintaining their ability to be home, maintaining that they, you know, can stay with their families. So it's not to preclude any progressive or chronically ill adult or child, but still we are there maintaining all of that system, their body systems, even though there is declines.
Right. So Representative Benson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, maybe I need to check the dictionary again, but I think optimal really simply means to bring people to the level that they can be. I don't think there's a conflict in terms here at all.
Okay, so let's see. Representative Albright?
I have a question with regard to the bill itself. And pardon my maybe refreshing my memory from the informational meeting, but this is pertinent to individuals who are not in hospice, correct?
Correct.
So the question goes to, it is not child-specific, Madam Chair?
Well, I think it's child-specific, right? The bill is no. Okay. Mm-hmm. They say it is not child-specific.
Could you elaborate in terms of, is it for the elongation of the circumstances of any type of, because I'm going to line 1.6, where it says recipients, but I hear a lot of conversation from the testifiers that it's from a pediatric perspective, child-specific focus, but I just heard that it's for the purpose of adults as well, so I just want to kind of understand, mm-hmm. Before I ask a couple more questions, what we're dealing with, if it's pediatric, if it's geriatric, you know, what specifically are we discussing here?
Madam Chair, members, the issue accounts for home care nursing across the board for all ages. My personal experience has been predominantly with children, but I think to answer the question about optimal care, some of these conditions in the adults as well as in children are progressive, and so maybe the term to maintain them at a reasonable state of health means to maintain them at home to decrease their costs during this process of where their disease may be slowly progressive, but some of these diseases can be decades before their lifespan comes to an end in association with that disease process. So optimal changes from individual to individual. It's not just maintaining them, it's supporting them and keeping them at home and keeping them out of a hospital setting.
Hey, Representative Albright, you had something else?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we're all familiar with the coding that goes into reimbursement rates, whether it be in a hospital or whether it be in a clinical setting or even an in-home. And I'm just curious in terms of, are the codes different pertinent to if this care is provided in a hospital setting versus a clinical setting versus a home care setting? I'm wondering if there's a different code that is identified for the type of care, specifically to the logistical setting that it's provided in.
Yeah, and before you answer that, I just want to say, Representative Albright, we are on the A2 amendment.
Yes.
So, I mean, I'll let the witnesses answer, but then we need to kind of decide what to do with this amendment, and then we can discuss the more about the bill. But we did have a full hearing on the bill. So,
Madam Chair, I'll let my witness say it. The codes are different, and actually, if you're in the home, it's cheaper. and or less. And also, I've had in my nursing experience clients who are 4 months old in that we're caring for that had to wait 4 months to get around the clock nursing established so they could come to Faribault. And then I have a 62-year-old male in my area and a 19-year-old son. So it runs the whole perspective, the whole gamut of age. So, and I'll turn that over to my testifier.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, where I work, we do infants all the way up to 85 in the home that require this care. And in the home, the billing is the same for, it's just the difference between RN and LPN and the modifier TG for complex or not complex. And the hospitals and clinics, they have different HCPC codes, which are your billing procedure codes, than we do in home care that are reimbursed at a much higher rate.
Okay, and Representative Albright, anything else that would go to the amendment?
No, I'll hold further
okay.
until we get the amendment done.
All right, questions to the amendment. Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, I've talked to the people bringing the bill forward, and I think optimal means well, but I don't think it's an optimal use of the word optimal. So I think, have we voted on this yet?
No.
I'll just move to strike the word optimal.
Okay, thank
and this
you.
Is going to go to finance along the way if right. they need something else to describe.
Okay, so Representative Abler modifies his amendment to remove the word optimal.
Thank
okay.
you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, members, are we ready to vote on the amendment, or are there further questions? Or okay. Okay. I think we're ready to vote on the amendment. So, on the A2 as modified, to take out the word optimal, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Okay. Then, members, to the bill as amended, and see, we did do all the amendments, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. So, the bill as amended is before us, and the motion would be to re-refer to health and... I will. So the motion that we're going to be discussing and then voting on will be to re-refer to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. So, Representative Albright, did you have something more on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on lines 2.12 and 2.13 as modified, we're changing from 14 to 19 and from 21 to 19. And this goes back to my earlier question in terms of to the codes that are utilized, whether you know they are provided in a hospital, clinical, or home-based setting. I'm just wondering the rationale or the logic, if you were, in terms of why peg it at 19? Why not 25? Or why not establish it where it was at 14 and 21. Why the increase to 19?
Who'd like to address that? Ms. Flynn?
Madam Chair and members, in the original bill we had posted three different rates, and historically DHS does across the board increases or decreases, and 19 is an average of the three added together, and you know, try to see if that would be a way, because with our reimbursement has been cut for many years, and we don't compare to the hospital reimbursement, and we have a larger liability in home care because we don't have the doctor next door or the RT or the OT. So we're trying to catch up so we can keep our staff, and that's how we came to it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, obviously, this would be an increase to a provider for providing those services. So, is it in direct reflection an offset to the cost savings? Where can you justify mm-hmm. the increase in costs for the savings in in-home care?
Can you,
Madam Chair,
that?
Members? It is to, for one, so we can keep our staff, and it is cheaper to care for your clients at home. Where they thrive than in the hospital, which is more than 2, 3, 4 times the cost. Because these are miniature ICUs, some of these clients, in a home. And everything that they do in the ICU, except for surgery maybe, is done in the home. And we do a doctor's orders from the home as a triage to keep them out of the clinics when there's a lot of illnesses out there, mm-hmm. to keep them out of the ER where there's illness, and keep them out of the hospital where there's illness. And we keep track of how many times we get antibiotics ordered and started right away and keep them out of the hospital. It's a huge cost savings.
Right. And members, too, remember, we're sending this to finance, and so that's kind of where we'll hash out, or we can get more deeply into these issues of, you know, what relative costs should be. Representative Albright.
I just have one more question, then, and whether the testifiers or Representative Huntley can answer this in terms of, it would certainly appear that there's going to be an increase in cost coming into one department's funding or revenue need. So I'm wondering where that funding is going to come from, if it's been determined.
Well, I don't know if Representative Huntley wants to address that, but the fact that we're sending a bill to his committee doesn't mean funding's been determined at all. It doesn't mean it's going to be funded at all, Representative Albright. So I think it's probably a little premature to ask that question. I mean, we pass lots of bills that, you know, as Representative Abler said, when you're in the minority, you can ask for lots of things to be funded without giving a thought to where the money would come from. So
I'm just asking, you know, from a constituent standpoint, that someone's going to have to pay for this. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know, when I ask the questions asked to me, that I have an answer from a constituent. Who's going to pay for this ticket?
Okay, Ms. Blinn, you want to address that?
Madam Chair and members, actually, this bill will help us to utilize MA less, if you can believe it or not, because we can get our private insurances to pay their fair share first and make MA truly the payer of last resort. So it'll be a fiscally positive note in the long run, as I've proven from my agency standpoint of appealing and winning for this care.
Right. All right. Thanks, Representative Albright. And also, I think she raised a very good point that we don't get fiscal notes in this committee, but when it goes to Representative Huntley's committee, there will be a fiscal note, and that'll give us all more information. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know where the money's going to come from when we don't even know what it's going to cost. So thank you. Okay, other members, questions, comments?
Jim.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, ma'am. Just a comment that the testimony last time talked about people stacked up in a very expensive place trying to get out, and this is meant to free that up, and maybe there'll be enough savings to pay for the last bill that we did, so Chair Huntley can do both. Thank you.
All right. All right, so seeing no further discussion then, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 2023, I think it is, be re-referred as amended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And
thank you.
On its way. Thank you very much. All right. The next bill is mine, and if it's okay with everybody, I'm just going to stay here and do this, because there's really no testimony to be had. This is a bill that we heard, and we're just bringing it up again because we heard it before session when we couldn't move it anywhere. But we had a full hearing on this. If you recall, it's really a technical update to a bill that we passed last session. And so the motion on this would be to re-refer it to the Committee on Civil Law. So I would move that House File 2005 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. They should all be as easy as that one. Okay. All right, so the next bill on the agenda is House File 1987. And as Representative Moran is coming up to the table, I just want to remind members that this is a bill that we started to hear during the interim hearing that we had, and we ran out of time, and members didn't get an opportunity. We heard testimony from Commissioner Carter on this bill, and I think that was the only testifier. But we did run out of time. There wasn't time for members to ask questions, to do anything more with it. So I wanted to bring it up again today, give members an opportunity to and let us hear any testimony from the public. And then the intention would be that this would be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So we're not going to vote on it today. And members don't need to, there won't be amendments taken unless there's an author's amendment, which I don't think there is. There's no amendment, right?
No.
Representative Moran, no
yes,
amendment.
Yes, that's correct.
So the process is that this would be laid over for possible inclusion, and then at the end of toward the end of deadlines, as I mentioned during when we first heard this bill, the process is that toward the end of deadlines, there will be a day when we get done hearing the bills, we will have a proposed omnibus bill. We'll take testimony from the public on that omnibus bill, and then there'll be a day to mark it up, so there will be an opportunity for members to offer amendments at that time. So just, you know, keep track as we go through if there are things that you particularly are concerned about, want to watch for, and just know that not everything that gets heard ends up in the omnibus bill either. So, you know, just so you understand that that's the process. So with that, Representative Moran, did you want to start by, did you want to make any comment on the bill to sort of refresh memories or anything additional you want to say?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just as a quick reflection of the bill or summary of the bill, in 2012, the legislature passed an imposing bill, an unfunded mandate requiring drug testing of participants in the Minnesota Family Investment Program and those who receive general assistance. And so this bill is just to repeal that decision that was brought down in 2012. And so I think members are pretty much know what this bill intends and the purpose of it. And so I would like for us to go from that opening statement to any testifiers we may have.
Okay. All right. So are there any anybody in the audience here, any members of the public or anyone who... Oh, I do. I'm sorry. I guess I have people who have said they want to testify. So Jessica Webster, is she here? Okay. We've got a second person, Marcia Cressy. Okay. Anybody have questions or anything they want to say in the meantime? Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I was in charge of this bill at the time, and I was just doing some research about how it came to be, and I was interested in the testimony last time and the challenges that the counties are having in implementing this, but I was trying to remember back why we did this in the first place. And Madam Chair and members, the previous law was that these individuals were supposed to self-report to the county or whomever in this of these individuals, their status, and there was a disincentive to do that. And working with Jerry Kerber at licensing, Representative Driskowski had then found this as a part of the solution, and so I can count votes and I know how these sort of things go, but I. If there's a way to kind of try to capture the what we are trying to do, the goal of helping these individuals who are chemically dependent, who tend to recur in their dependency, no program that I know suggests that that's a good thing to let them continue with that. But they should be, you know, interdicted in some way to get their attention and then give them some treatment. And maybe the answer isn't the way the bill read, that they would lose everything, but maybe there, as this bill, I think it's going to stay in the committee for a while, maybe there's a way to actually make this a functional program, to actually kind of be a little bit of outreach and some kind of tough love to these individuals. I know in the past we've had sanctions at differing levels, but I don't have a specific suggestion, Madam Chair, but just to report some of the intent when this got passed in the first place. It wasn't to be punitive, at least that was my take on it, but a way to kind of provide some disincentive for people to continue with their drug use and to try to become the productive citizens that we know they could be. And so this will be sitting here for a while, and I just want to raise that idea that there might be a way to get some benefit out of this, and maybe having the counties do it and not having a mechanism and money and all that doesn't make sense. But I just wanted to throw it out, Madam Chair, as a thought that as these individuals would be somehow discovered, that they would be remediated some way. So that's my thought. Thanks.
Okay.
Hey, thank you, Representative Abler. And I think we're, I don't know if our testifiers are on the way or we don't, I guess.
Madam Chair, I know Jessica Webster was here earlier. I saw her as I was sitting there, but.
Okay, Representative Moran, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, I think Representative Tara won.
Oh. Okay, Representative Matt.
Yeah. Ladies first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just one question to Representative Abler's point. Am I under the correct understanding? Was it self-reporting prior? When did this, when did the drug testing, I mean, this is the House research, when did this pass where drug testing was implemented as part of participating in these, in these programs?
Ms. Pugnelli?
Madam Chair and members, it's my understanding that the language requiring the drug testing of persons convicted of felony drug offenses has been in statute for quite a while, I believe since 1997 when the MFIP statute was first enacted into law. The thing that is new that just became effective on July 1st of last year is some reporting requirements between the state court administrator and DHS identifying these individuals. Before that language was enacted, people that had drug convictions were expected to self-report.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's very, very helpful, I think, sometimes when we talk about this issue just in, you know, quick snippets of conversation, drug reporting for people on MFIP and who need some, you know, some help from the state to get back on their feet. I think kind of looking and digging a little bit deeper into this issue gives you a little bit of a clear-cut picture of what we're dealing with in the sense that, you know, if there has been a felony or a conviction, like Representative Abler said, I guess I just support that line of thinking. And when I've been in contact with people on this issue that work at chemical dependency facilities and our state nonprofits that are trying to help some of these folks, you know, accountability is key, trying to get these people the help that they need. And so, you know, I see the recent change that was put into place as the state not only be trying to be accountable with resources, but to really try to help get these people the help that they need. And I like what the direction Representative Abler is going in terms of, you know, crafting something in the future that if it gets to this point, these people are applying for MFIP, they're identified as having a drug conviction, that maybe there's another path that they can follow with some assistance, but also getting help so that we're not possibly compounding a problem. We're not offering the help that I think we as elected officials are responsible to offer to folks kind of finding themselves in this cycle of dependency. And people on this committee know what where that leads and the destruction that that brings to families and communities. So with that, that's just the thing really on my mind and my concern with doing away with it altogether and moving forward with this bill. I'm not quite sure that we're doing the best service we can for these individuals. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mack. And I don't think the bill does away with it altogether. I think that what it does is there are kind of two sections to it. And one is the piece that Commissioner Carter testified about, that by changing the may to shall, in terms of by saying that the counties shall test people, that it created a big burden on the counties. And I know you weren't able to be here for the hearing, Representative Mack, but that was a lot of this is about that counties have been given what amounts to an unfunded mandate, and that the returns on it, the number of people that actually screen positive, is very small, but the amount of time and effort that and expense of counties going out and finding everybody is quite extensive. So it just basically returns that county flexibility. That's at least the first piece. And then on the second piece, and I see our testifiers here, I'm going to let her talk, but I have to tell you that I think one of the problems with this whole policy is that it doesn't require, if somebody's found to be using, it doesn't require them to be offered any resources to help them actually recover. And I think people in this committee understand that drug addiction is a chronic disease. It's a chronic illness, and it usually doesn't get better by itself. And so rather than having a punitive policy, I'd like to see us, at least in a future year, maybe not this year, but in a budget year, really think about how to make sure that we bring resources to bear so that that person gets more than just a slap, that they actually get some help if they indeed have a problem. So I think I'm hearing that from you as well, Representative Mack. I appreciate that. So Jessica Webster is here, so let's give her a chance to add anything she would like to add, and doesn't sound like we need to go on with this too much longer, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And, you know, we support Representative Moran's bill for about three primary reasons. One was already mentioned, so I won't spend a lot of time on the fact that this really does nothing for treatment. And we are talking about some folks who, you know, made a mistake 16 years ago or 10 years ago. So that's, it's not just folks who recently had a drug conviction. It's people who have really moved on with their lives. And even though they're still poor, still low income, many of these folks have moved on, have been clean for a really long time. The first primary reason, though, that we really fundamentally support Representative Moran's bill is just that this is not good government. Drug testing low-income people because they're low-income is not efficient government. You heard last month that Ramsey County is spending upwards of $1,000 per case. And why does that matter? It matters because Ramsey County is one of the counties that ran out of emergency assistance dollars last fall, and Legal Aid was scrambling and worried that once again we were going to have children evicted from their homes on Christmas. And so there is this crushing demand for other basic services such as shelter and food. The second example I can give is we've heard from counties they need more support in processing SNAP applications. You've seen a bill this session. You saw a bill last session to give counties more time to get federal SNAP benefits out the door. It used to be that if you were homeless and had zero income, there was a 24-hour turnaround for getting your federal SNAP food assistance. Now sometimes we ask people to wait a week. So if there is such crushing demand at the county level to serve basic needs for children, why are we adding a new requirement to counties for drug testing when they already can't meet basic needs for families? That's one of our major concerns. The second concern, because I am from an organization that represents low-income people who can't afford private attorneys, is a constitutional one. We have serious constitutional questions about whether this violates people's rights. And while the language and the decisions out of Florida were not determinative for Minnesota, it's a big red flag. And so I think that people who care about the legal landscape and what it means to be drug testing people because they are poor should really look at the language of those decisions and what that means for people's rights. Thank you for your time.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess I have concerns about weakening the standard. I understand what you're saying, but, you know, and I appreciate the fact that there's a small percentage that's actually showing up as far as testing positive. And to me, that sends a signal that it's working, okay? And, you know, when you weaken that standard, human nature being what it is, these people already have had evidently a problem with addiction. And we all know that falling back into addiction is an easy thing to do. I think my wife's addicted to me, to tell you the truth. No. Just kidding. So I think that even though there's a cost and a burden, it's worth it because it keeps people, other people, from falling into recidivism, and that costs the state even more in other areas. You know, the example I would say is, what if we had DWI offenses and we did this same language? Okay, do you think you'd have less DWI problems if you put you may lose your license, there's a possibility. No, you shall lose your license. And when you're receiving government benefits, okay, and I did when I was in the military, got a government paycheck, and evidently here, but you have a responsibility also. So it's not just about a constitutional issue of, well, you're receiving benefits and then you do something illegal, I don't see where the constitutionality is of that. I see that you have a responsibility when you're using other people's money to support yourself. And I'm not saying that all of us can't fall into that situation. But I think you're going to, when you weaken this, you're going to see more recidivism. You're sending the wrong message. And you're promoting more of an irresponsible message than a responsibility of staying away from illegal drugs. And again, human nature needs consequences for negative behavior. And this weakens the consequences, and therefore you're going to get more of the negative behavior and ultimately higher cost in other areas from whatever you think you're saving. That's my perspective. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Human nature needs consequences for negative behavior. I'll keep that in mind. who's next? Representative Albright and then Huntley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, on page 2, as I look at the modifications to this, one word comes to mind frequently, and it's the word may versus shall. And I think, you know, not to trot over ground that Representative Grunhagen has already, you know, gone over. But I'm just curious, in your estimation, what the propensity for a county to conduct a drug a certification would be if we only give them the option in a may situation. How often do you think that would occur? What conditions would need to be present in order for the county to feel it incumbent upon themselves to conduct a random drug test?
I believe we have someone here from the county that can maybe answer that
here before. We have somebody from the county. Oh, there she is. Mm-hmm. We knew you weren't going to get away with that coming down. Welcome to the committee. Did you hear the question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Ring. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's nice to see you all again. Well, I would say the answer to the question is, in the past, before the shall, there were counties that did drug testing. And so I think that what counties are looking for is the flexibility to use their resources and their best judgment to use this tool when they think it's most necessary. Versus the way the law is currently written.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What conditions need to be present right now? Is it based upon marker on 2.3 for a drug conviction in the last 10 years? Is that the baseline? Or are there other conditions that are present for you to be required right now to perform a drug test?
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Maybe I can share an example of, you know, I know Representative Steve Drakowski brought this bill forward because what I heard is that in his city where he lived, which is about 800 or so people, it was told to him that someone within his district was using state funds to purchase drugs. And it's kind of like, it's my thought, like pretty much common sense, that at a local level in a community with there's 800 plus individuals, that person could have been reported to the county, which in turn would have allowed the county to do what they were charged to do a drug testing of that individual. I think, you know, in that case, I mean, it just makes really sense that the county can take that control of that drug testing instead of putting the burden on statewide counties to do a mandatory drug testing, which is really taking services away from families who are really in need and crisis.
Thank you. Representative Albright, anything further on that?
You know, and maybe just as an op-ed then on line 2.9, you're looking for, and I absolutely agree with what Representative Mack and Abler have said in the past about rather than sanctions of a punitive nature, the intention of this is to help people rescue themselves from, you know, addiction. I'm just wondering if, in, you know, as a suggestion, maybe rather than the word sanctions, you could expand on that to provide for assistance and or rehabilitation from. It seems like that's a natural marker for inserting language such that you get away from the sanctionable argument and make it more productive and proactive for the sake of the individual. I'll leave it at that.
Right. Representative Albright, I love that idea.
So
I think it's great, and I think other people around this table probably agree with you as well. And my sense is that we probably can't do that this year because of a budget impact that would take, but I think it would be a great thing if this committee in the future, you know, if you or other members want to, you know, work on what that would look like, I think that would be outstanding, and I would, you know, join you in that effort. So, other members have, I'm sorry, Representative Huntley.
I'll pass.
Okay, Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't want to, you know, get into a long debate about this, but it seems, you know, over the years that I've been here that there's always a great concern that people who are getting public assistance or those in the lower economic ranks of society are somehow getting away with something. And the notion that simply because we do not see a certain percentage or find or discover a certain percentage of the population who are getting assistance are not on drugs doesn't mean that they ever were. And legislators who are concerned about that should think about other groups in our society. For example, should we have a group a drug testing for young people who apply to our state colleges or universities? After all, there is a taxpayer subsidy in that regard, or if students get student loans, should we have all those young people also take drug tests? I just think it's interesting that so many people in our society are so concerned about those who are at the very bottom of our society and very struggling to survive, that they're the ones who most likely are the cheaters. Those are the ones who are the drug takers, and that's probably why they're poor. I just don't think that construction is correct, and I think it's rather pernicious, actually.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Actually, it sounds like you might be wanting to have a bill to have legislators be drug tested. That sounds kind of familiar.
That was taken out of committee.
I was alluding to that we had that. It was my amendment, and it was removed in conference. Right. Right.
We passed that.
Okay. Yes, we did. We passed it off the House floor. Yes, we did. Okay. So I think, members, if there are no further questions, we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And we have actually finished in real speed today, which thank you all very much. And so we will not need to meet this evening. Right. Imagine that, the first day, and we're not meeting in the evening. But do plan that we will be meeting most evenings to finish our agenda. I mean, there's just really no other way to do that.
We can
all talk fast or not talk, as the case may be.
Can talk faster.
Okay. Well, you're sitting next to him, so you can give him the elbow. And so I think then, members, for the day, we are adjourned. See you.